Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
Open the pod bay doors now.
I'm sorry, Dan. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the most you ever lost in the contest?
Go ahead. Make my day.
Hello and welcome back to Black Hole Cinema. My name's Dan Taylor and I'm back in the hosting chair for the first time since our summer break. And also joining us from since the break is failed critics Owen Hughes.
Hello.
And Mr. Chris Haig.
Hello.
How are you both?
I'm good.
Yeah, all right, thank you. How are you?
Not too bad. What's been going on in the world of failed critics then, Owen?
What has been going on? I should have prepared something. We've been doing quite well lately. I'm quite pleased with how Power Critics is running at the moment. We've had a Corridor of Praise episode where we inducted Danny Dyer. That seemed to be quite popular. Unexpectedly popular, I would think.
Brilliant. It inspired me to buy Assassin on DVD the other day. So
I was going to pick you up on that. Did you watch it?
Yeah.
Have you?
I haven't yet.
Okay.
Because I got back to my hotel room and I realised I didn't have a DVD player. I'd left my laptop in the car. So in the end, I had to instead watch the rerun of Question Time, which, you know, it's a...
Two polar opposites there.
In kind of ballpark, isn't it, really?
But otherwise, it's been going quite well. Thanks. Yeah.
Good, and you can find Owen and the Failed Critics at failedcritics.com and on Twitter, obviously Failed Critics. Chris, have you been up to much in the podcasting internet world?
In the podcasting internet world, not much over the summer. Tom East and I run Fan Friction, and we took a nice summer break because we were both very busy with real life stuff, which basically is just we couldn't be bothered. No, I shouldn't say that. We genuinely did have a lot of stuff going on. We came back a few weeks ago, I believe it was at the start of August, and we're taking a little break just while we get through some more stuff and planning. But yeah, it's going well on Fan Friction and just having fun and reading out things that people send us, no matter how mortifying they really are. So
wonderful. And you can find Fan Friction on Twitter as well.
Yeah.
Reviews coming up in the show. We are looking at Everest as well as M. Night Shyamalan's The Visit. We'll be revisiting the Hall of Fame, and this week we'll be inducting directors who have been fortunate enough to win an Academy Award. We'll also be looking at the UK and the US box office about midway through the show to compare how both sides are getting on in the cinema world. But first, we've got the news. Chris, what news story have you got for us this week?
I have got a piece of news very dear to my heart, which is that Universal have not exactly pulled the plug, but they have halted production on Pacific Rim 2, which is a Guillermo del Toro film that he had said he was going to put into works, and which there's a script that's currently being written for the any of you who aren't aware. It is a 2013 film where basically it's mankind in robots trying to punch the crap out of invading sea demons, and it's awesome. It really is. It's the most kind of visceral, you know, kind of childlike joy in just seeing them beat the crap out of, you know, sea monkeys. It's joyous. So I'm a bit disappointed that Universal have decided to do this. I mean, I believe it's off the back of a couple of big failures that they've recently had. I can't tell you what those failures are because I can't remember them, which might actually say something for why they've decided to halt Pacific Rim 2. I believe they were genre offerings, so I don't know. Del Toro has said that he will be moving on with it, and you know he will still be putting a script in and putting an actual kind of outline forward, and that he is still planning to do it, but he may do another film in the interim. So I really hope that this is just like a temporary setback, because I really love the film and it's, you know, very well regarded. So yeah, I just want to see more people beating the crap out of monsters with Rock'em Sock'em robots.
He's obviously got the strain to keep him busy.
But he's also got Crimson Peak coming out next month, which I'm ridiculously excited to see. Because I'm not a huge Victorian Gothic horror fan, but I've seen the trailers for it and I'm like, oh, this looks amazing. So I'm going to try and drag a load of friends around Halloween time to go see it. It looks really good.
It's an interesting one, actually, Crimson Peak. So I'll be interested to see how that one gets on. It will certainly be a break from the usual Paranormal Activity rubbish.
Yes, exactly.
Which there's another one of those coming up as well.
Oh, no. Oh,
it does look a little bit like Insidious meets The Woman in Black to me. And
But
if you've got Guillermo del Toro's sort of visual style to it, I'm sure it will be interesting, but I'm not so confident. I don't know how well it's going to work. I think it's going to hinge on the performances, and particularly it looks like Tom Hiddleston's going to be a big part of it.
Yeah. It's certainly got a more reputable cast than those two, isn't it, really?
Yes.
Because obviously Insidious has got Rose Byrne, and that's about it.
But I like Patrick Wilson. Patrick Wilson's pretty good.
Yeah. But obviously, you know, is it Mia Wasikowska? Is she in this?
Wasikowska.
Yeah, she's in this one, isn't she?
Yes.
You know, as you said, Jessica Chastain, Tom Hiddleston. So really, actually, quite a big cast for a kind of horror. Moving on swiftly, my news is also very kind of middle of the road, comic booky related. It's all to do with Zack Snyder's swipe at the Ant-Man film, which released this year, and basically how he's saying that his film coming up, Batman vs Superman, won't be the flavour of the week, as he called it, as Ant-Man was. And it's currently the Marvel film that's taken the least amount of money recently, but that doesn't say much, really, because it did take a stonking amount of money anyway. In reply, Sebastian Stan, who plays Bucky Barnes in The Winter Soldier and also coming up in the next Captain America film, obviously Civil War, he basically replied, basically saying, I'm sitting here and I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, do I want to fire some shots at DC right now at Zack Snyder? I read some of the comments where he said something about Batman and Superman, and I can't remember where I read that. Somewhere, something about it's not going to be the flavor of a week, Ant-Man. And I was like, oh yeah, thanks, Zach. That's a great way to do something original. Not exactly very classy, though, is it, from Zack Snyder?
No.
I think he's got a point in a sense. You know, Ant-Man's... It was an entertaining little film, but I think 50% of the people who've seen it have probably forgotten all about it by now. Whereas Batman vs Superman isn't going to be that flavour of the week sort of film because it's Batman and Superman.
Yes.
Probably nothing to do with Zack Snyder is why it won't be just the you know, that month's big film. It's because of the characters who are in it. And probably ahead of Zack Snyder, the actors who are in it. You know, Ben Affleck, for crying out loud. He's pretty big now. I mean, he's really huge, a big proper movie star. So if anything is going to attract people to seeing that film, it'll be A, Batman, B, Superman, or C, Ben Affleck. I don't think Zack Snyder's... He should really be bragging about it, because at the end of the day, he's not going to be the person who sells that film, to be honest.
No. Well, if you know, anybody mentions the name Zack Snyder, I just think of all the awful films that he's made, or the kind of big crash-bang-wallop messes.
I do like Zack Snyder as a director, and I'm kind of looking forward to seeing what he does with such a big film. And I keep saying it after everything he does, that I still think he's got a big, really popular film in him. And I just hope he didn't do that too soon with 300. We'll see.
I certainly don't think we'll be inducting him into our Hall of Fame.
Well, wait till you see who gets in there later.
Yeah. not be a surprise. and our final story, Owen.
Yeah, final story. Just one I came across earlier, which caught my eye, actually, on the BBC News website. The headline just says, Martin Amis' film dropped from Toronto amid legal row. Basically, what's going on at the moment is the Toronto International Film Festival, obviously in Canada. And this guy's film, London Field, by Matthew Cullen, he claimed the producers added incendiary imagery without approval. Basically, what he's saying is he finished his film, he handed it back, and what he thought was going to be published, what was going to be distributed, actually is not his film. He's saying they've added all these extra bits in, nothing that was in the script, nothing that was in nothing that he shot either. So this is actual, like, could be stock footage, or it could be, you know, they've got some other guy behind Cullen's back to come in and produce these last images, these last scenes. And he's now going through legal action in Los Angeles about this. And he wants his name taken off the film. But why I thought it was quite interesting is because this kind of thing happens, well, I wouldn't say quite a lot. That might be exaggerating. But it does sort of happen every so often with these bigger films. Because this film's got people like Johnny Depp in it. It's got Johnny Depp's wife, Amber Heard, who's in it as well. It's one of those where, is he right to want his name taken off it? And I'll say why. What the producers have come out with, they've issued a statement which is brilliant. The way they've worded this is brilliant. Sadly, Matthew can't deal with the fact that he does not control the final cut of the movie, which I think is very bitchy. I'm sure they were lifting their handbags up when they were saying that. And then he was given two deadlines to deliver a director's cut and missed both deadlines. His guild has rules for withdrawing his name from the picture, and he missed those deadlines. So there's quite an interesting bit of background politics going on there. Mm. And it kind of gives you an insight into where producers come from, because obviously to them, they're telling this guy to make them a saleable product. It's retail. You know, we're giving you this money. We want you to adapt this because we think we can make profit on it if you do well. And he's given them something different to what they've asked for. Because obviously, at the same time, he's an artist creating a bit of art. And that isn't always the most marketable product. So you've kind of got this tug of war between the two of them. And I think it'll be interesting to see who wins in this, particularly as, you know, the statement from the producers is he was given these ultimatums, he was given these deadlines, and he blew them. So why should they bend to his will, really?
I wonder how much truth's in that, though, that, you know, if he was given the opportunity to take his name off the film. Mm. You know, was it before these changes were made, even? Did he submit his finished product, then go, are you sure you want to put your name on this? And
yeah.
Then they go ahead and change a load of shit. He goes to the test screening and goes, wait, what? This isn't the movie I made. which sounds very familiar to recent events. Obviously, going back to Fantastic Four being a very different movie.
Yeah.
Josh Trank was very vocal in that, wasn't he?
Mm. Mm, yeah. So you've got lots of directors, I think, kicking off at the moment about the kind of influence and effect that producers and studios have. But when you're working for organisations like this, where it is their film, it's not your film, whether you want to say it is or not. It is a film that belongs to them. If you want to make your film, go off and, you know, fund it yourself, make your own independent film. Or have the kind of money and influence that people like Tarantino does, and then you can say, you know, this is my movie. But when you're effectively working for somebody, you know, the final cut, as it were, the final decisions doesn't mm-hmm. fall to you, but falls to your boss, just as it would at work.
Well, precisely. If you
work for a graphic design company, for example, you produce this piece of, you know, graphic design, and then it goes off to upstairs, and upstairs goes, oh, I don't quite like this, and they adjust it a little bit, and then when the finished product kind of comes out, it's not actually what you did at all, really. But obviously you're still being credited for it.
Yeah, and also, I mean, it's had its press screenings now, and you can sort of see from the producer point standpoint is, well, he's just waited for this to come out, and it's not done very well, and now he wants his name taken off it because he thinks we've ruined it. And it then put, there's a lot of fingers being pointed at each other for this, I think. So, but yeah, I just thought it was quite an interesting topic when I sort of stumbled across it online earlier.
Moving on to our first review, somebody that probably needs to take his name off films more often. Chris will be reviewing, rather, M. Night Shyamalan's The Visit.
Maybe we should go outside and film some evening shots of the house.
Okay, sounds good, sister.
Could you clean the oven for me, Becca? Get all the way inside.
Becca?
She's done it before.
We really should film Sally outside.
Do this first.
I'll be quick.
Oh, this'll just take a second.
Two children are sent to their grandparents' house to spend a week with their grandparents, obviously, while their single mum goes on a relaxing vacation with her boyfriend. One of the kids, Becca, decides to film a documentary about her grandparents in order to help her mum reconnect with her parents and also find out some things about her parents as well. While filming the documentary, however, Becca and her little brother, Tyler, discover a dark secret about their grandparents.
Yeah, so The Visit is kind of the latest offering for M. Night Shyamalan, who is... It's really sad in a way because over the past sort of 10 years, he's become synonymous with producing kind of crap, basically. There's no other way. There's you know, better words for it, but I'm trying to keep this a little bit PG. But he has produced some real stinkers over the years, including my least favourite film of all time, which is The Happening.
I quite like The Happening. I know it's sacrilege, but it's just so bad it's good. It cracks me up.
Yeah.
I laughed my way through all of it, and for that I can't hate it. I just think it's so funny.
I kind of think the same as well. And I love Mark Wahlberg. I can't do no wrong.
Anyway, so M. Night Shyamalan has basically done some really terrible films over the years, but he started out as kind of the new face on the block when it really came to the thriller and kind of the suspense twist thriller. So obviously he started with stuff like The Sixth Sense, which is more famous for the twist than the actual plot. Like, I can always tell you the twist of the film, but I can't tell you, oh, this happens and this happened, that sort of thing. And he did the film with Samuel L. Jackson, which is Unbreakable, and Signs, which was okay. And I think personally the best one I have seen, and until The Visit, the last one I saw in the cinema, which was The Village, which there is a twist in that which genuinely blindsided me in the last 20 minutes. And I just went, oh my God, and that was 10 years ago, and it was really well done, and it was not leaked in a trailer, nothing hinted at it, which I think is really interesting. So I went to see The Visit, and I was actually very pleasantly surprised. I mean, it's not a brilliant thriller. It does have its moments. It does have moments which are generally scary, because you have the two kids who, you know, they decide to film their visit kind of documentary style and get all kind of huge stuff from the grandparents and everything when weird stuff starts to happen. Because they basically get a curfew every night saying, oh, grandparents say, oh, well, we're an older generation, we go to bed early, you know, we'd appreciate if you basically stayed in bed. I think it's 9:30 or something, so they're like, oh, okay, whatever. And then it's obviously when they start going out that they start finding weird stuff going on. So it's a thriller that you could logically work out. There's no kind of 180 complete blindside twist. Like, if you thought about it, you thought, oh, okay, this logically does make sense. And this, you know, could happen and this could happen. And there are some genuinely good, you know, scares in it. There's some kind of jump out of the seat moments, which I think are done quite well. The acting is quite good in it. The only person who I could recognise among the cast was Catherine Hahn, who has been in tons of stuff. Like, I remember her recently from Parks and Rec, but she only pops in really as the mother of the two kind of protagonists, which are the children, who both do their job, you know, fairly well and everything. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing really much to say about it. It's a perfectly serviceable, quite okay thriller. It's popcorn. It's a very good Friday night thriller to go and see. You know, you'll walk out not being, you know, traumatised or anything. It won't, you know, you won't be upset at it. It definitely won't be anyone's, like, top film of the year, and it won't even be the best film M. Night Shyamalan has ever put his name to, but it's quite good, it's quite enjoyable. And at the end of the day, when it comes to people like M. Night Shyamalan, who, sadly, his work kind of veers from The Sixth Sense, which is quite scary and quite brilliant and quite fresh, to something like Lady in the Water. But yeah, so The Visit's alright, actually. I went into this thinking it was going to be absolutely awful, and it was actually, you know, pretty okay. So I'm quite happy with that. I wasn't expecting miracles or anything, but it was just... it was all right.
An improvement on After Earth, or...?
Well, if it helps, I've not actually seen After Earth, because the last Will and Jane Smith film I saw was... they did The Pursuit of Happiness, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was good.
There was nothing really about After Earth that I thought, oh, okay, this isn't, you know, whatever. I, for my sins, I did see a bit of the... he did the Avatar movie a few years ago, was it?
Yeah, Last Airbender he did.
Airbender, yeah. That's it. Which I've never seen the original kind of anime or the manga or whatever it is. But I saw a bit of it. And I didn't pay for it. It was on... oh, this is how genius it is. I saw it on a TV station in Tunisia a few years ago. and it was so great in that it was so, so bad.
Yeah.
That I switched to Al Jazeera and I just listened to the news in Arabic, and I thought, still better. I don't know what to say in Arabic, but this is still better than watching a load of random people just do awful things to what I'm told is a well-beloved anime. So.
You could stick a Sharpie in your eye and have a better time than watching Last Airbender. It is terrible.
Yeah. Well,
and yet, weirdly, he did... I can't remember if he wrote it or if he just produced it. Was it Devil a few years ago?
Yeah, he produced Devil.
He, you know, it said from M. Night Shyamalan, and he was a producer on it. And I thought that was okay. I mean, I wouldn't watch it, you know, regularly. But the idea of these five or six people trapped in the elevator and there's a supernatural presence, I thought that's actually not bad for him. His future lies more in producing and kind of nurturing new scary talents. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's quite... I get that.
Yeah, I think since Signs, he's pretty much consistently made rubbish.
All I will say... is The Visit's actually okay.
Yeah.
Because I quite liked The Village, because I remember seeing it when I was a teenager with friends, and we remember getting really freaked out, because at the time, oh, this is so geeky, but at the time was when they really had, you know, pushed the websites, you know, interactive websites for the movies, and because it was Warner Brothers, they were used to doing a lot of the Harry Potter stuff. So I remember, you know, putting headphones in, going on The Village thing, because I was really excited to see it, and it was all like, but the red is the bad colour, it must not be worn, and I was just like, oh my god, this sounds terrifying, like it's some kind of fucked up demon thing coming to just eat everybody, and I was just like, oh, okay, this is actually pretty good. And like I said, the twist in the last 15-20 minutes, it really threw me the first time I saw it, and then on reflection I'm like, oh, that's actually very weirdly smart, that, in like a really weird, you know, 180 way. No one has no idea it's going to happen in cinema, because there was just a collective kind of, what the fuck is that?
I can remember what the twist is, but not the logic behind it. So all I can remember is, you know, well, I won't say it in case anyone's listening and hasn't seen it yet, but I can remember what happens, but not why it happens. So I've just got this weird memory of that film, of like thinking, what the fuck is going on? Why is this happening?
See, he hasn't really done anything... spectacular. I mean, far from the opposite, his kind of work has taken a significant downturn. So to see him actually doing something that isn't fantastic, but it's solid and it's enjoyable, and it doesn't try and beat you over the head with its kind of clever, twisty, oh, look at me, aren't I being really high concept? It's like, no, you're just being annoying. It's great being high concept if you can pull it off. But that's my problem. That's my issue with The Happening, is that it's such a cool high concept sci-fi Warren Ellis kind of idea of, you know, oh, it's a biologically released pathogen or whatever from nature that causes people to kill themselves. I'm like, that's really smart. And then he's done it in such a ham-fisted, miscast, just generally awful sort of way. It's not that a film is deliberately going out to be shit. It's that it starts off with best intentions and then has... it's none of it is reflected in the decent product.
I think he will struggle to get away from that reputation, and it probably will hinder The Visit. And I think the other thing that people get annoyed about, it you know, and it's a byproduct of having twists, is that it's almost become acceptable to talk about what the twists are in M. Night Shyamalan films. Because, you know, you get films like Planet of the Apes, Star Wars, Soylent Green, where you know what the spoiler is because it's popular culture to talk about the twist. Yeah. And the same thing happened to, you know, Sixth Sense, as you sort of mentioned earlier. People know what the twist is without necessarily knowing what the plot of the film is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it sort of hinders his reputation in that people will just wait to see what the twist is before possibly going to see his film.
Yeah, I think that's really, it kind of ties into the current thing of spoiler culture in that,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm awful for it in that if I see, you know, Game of Thrones spoilers or spoilers for Marvel or whatever, I will go read them because part of me is like, I don't really want to spend money in the cinema for something that, you know, oh, my favourite character dies or... Mm. This happens, and I'm really annoyed about it. So I get it. I mean, it's being discerning, because, you know, with the twist and everything, if people are like, oh, I'm going to like that, knowing that that happens, and like seeing the build-up to it, then that's great. But then equally, you've got this kind of thing where you don't... I mean, it's like I always check with people, particularly with someone like Game of Thrones, for example, where I'm like, oh, okay, so where are you up to? And they just say, oh, okay, well, this has happened now, and I have to kind of moderate it. If they said they're caught up with everything, then that's fine. If we're up to the same thing, because I would be mortified if I accidentally revealed some and people went, oh, I haven't actually got that. But, it would be like a knife to my soul. No, it's like, you know.
Do you know the website Mashable?
Don't think I've ever actually been on it. I've certainly been on it.
They have a lot of, you know, topics from news and media and all that kind of thing. Well, they had an article on their website before, which they published on Facebook. So I was following them on Facebook, and they had this thing that was complaining about spoilers.
Yeah.
And I used to read a lot of their articles at the time. And they was complaining about people and this like spoiler culture where people just go straight onto Twitter afterwards and say exactly what's happened and stuff.
Yes.
And I thought, okay, well, that might be interesting to read about some people complaining about spoilers. And I clicked on it, and the fucking first thing it has in there is a spoiler about Breaking Bad. It says, isn't this spoiler terrible? And then it reveals what happens. I'm like, what the fuck? How can you trick me?
That's mean. That's really cruel.
It's backwards, isn't it? I was so furious about that. But, you know, I always think, if in doubt, just don't mention it.
Just avoid the internet, just like, you know, on certain websites you can kind of, on Tumblr you can blacklist stuff, so you can, if it's like, say Breaking Bad, you can go Breaking Bad spoilers, BB spoilers, you know.
I end up having to just avoid Twitter every Saturday to wait for Match of the Day. If you go on Twitter, during the football, that's it.
How geeky is this? When you said on Saturday, I generally thought it was like, oh,
I actually haven't seen it yet, so don't spoil it for me.
Trailers are also a pain in the ass for spoilers.
Yes!
The trend for them at the moment seems to be put all of the best bits in the trailer so people will go and see it. And then you go and watch the film and it's just the best bits that are in the trailer padded out with loads of crap.
And particularly with thrillers that you can kind of piece them together. You can kind of figure out, oh, well, there's a tiny shot there where so-and-so is looking menacing. I bet they're the baddie, you know. Yeah.
Although I was really angry with the Gone Girl trailer, and then I saw the film, and I was like, oh, that was quite a clever trailer, because it made me think it was going to be this, and it wasn't.
Bringing it back full circle, as we slightly went off topic there.
Yeah, just
the whole back catalogue.
Yeah, we reviewed the whole back catalogue of M. Night Shyamalan, as well as his most recent film, The Visit. Tony's review is available on the accompanying blog, Black Hole Online. So check that one out. If not, you can rewind this and listen to it again if you want to. You know, whatever floats your boat. And moving on, we got coming up next is the box office top 10. Before we actually get into the top 10, interestingly, in the UK box office, Minions is still at number 11. After 12 weeks, taking $71 million in the UK alone. That's just incredible that that film is still hanging around, even though the summer is well and truly over. I know it was back in our cinema, my cinema's actually this weekend, so I'm sure it's the same over the country as well. The first place, number 10 in the UK box office, though, is Irrational Man. Have you heard much about this one?
It's a new Woody Allen film.
I try and avoid Woody Allen films. I know bits and pieces about Woody Allen, about this Rational Man, it's Joaquin Phoenix playing a literature professor, and he starts sleeping with a much younger student, because every Woody Allen film always has an older man forming a relationship with a very young college student, and I'm just like, oh, okay, that's really creepy if you think about his personal life. So yeah.
Number 10 in America is the Kate Mara and David Oyelowo, whose name probably isn't pronounced like that, the star, obviously, of Selma last year, is Captive. That's gone in at number 10 in the US, taking just over $1 million. Either of you know about this one?
I never heard of it. The only thing I know about it is it's very long and not been reviewed particularly well. All I've heard is that it just drags, but it's very slow. I don't think the performances have been criticised much, but it's just one of those that's very slow, which, you know, it's still early days. The reviews might pick up a bit when more people see it, but yeah, initial opinion is it's just a slow, torturous two and a half hours. Is it 2 hours 15? Two and a half, I think, maybe. So it's, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Over in the UK, number 9, The Empire Strikes Back. The Secret Cinema still raping our box office top 10 every week. Now it's been 15 weeks since they've been re-releasing Star Wars Episode 5. Whereas in the US, number 9 is the highly praised Straight Outta Compton. Matt Layton's review of that one is available on the blog. Number 8 in the UK is No Escape, which is the action thriller with Owen Wilson and Pierce Brosnan. It has taken 392,000 in the UK this week. After 2 weeks, it's taken nearly $2 million. I don't believe it's been released in the US yet. So it might find, it can find a better audience over there.
I think it comes out in the US in October.
But action films, Owen Wilson, what's he playing at? Just stick to comedies, Owen, you know.
Yeah.
You're not very good in those either, but action movies.
I thought it was really weird seeing the trailer with him as in an action film. And I was like, is he just wandered onto the wrong set? Like, you know, it's supposed to be like Chris Hemsworth or something, and Chris Hemsworth's there, you know, on Zoolander 2. And it's just like, they've just walked onto the wrong set. So I'm like, oh, okay, Owen Wilson in a thriller. Yeah, okay.
It's becoming quite trendy now, I think, to get these comedians to do serious dramas. You know, you've got Steve Carell in Foxcatcher.
Yeah. Yeah.
Seth Rogen's popping up in Steve Jobs. The other guy from Superbad was, you know, in Wolf of Wall Street and Moneyball and
Jonah
all that.
So, yeah.
Jonah Hill, that's him. Yeah.
Over in the US, number 8 is Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, which has taken $191 million in the US. After 8 weeks in the charts, it's sort of fallen three places this week, but I suspect it will hang on probably for another week because it is still taking money both sides of the pond. Because over in the UK, at number 7, I say I reviewed it. I scathingly reviewed it a couple of weeks ago on the Summer podcast. It was Pixels has dropped place and is in number 7, taking nearly $500,000 this week alone. I can't believe it's taken over $12 million in the UK. I just wish they would stop making Kevin James and Adam Sandler films. Number 7 in the US, A Walk in the Woods. I've got to be honest, know nothing about this one, but I believe it's coming up in the UK next week, I think. It's a film about walking, obviously. It's Robert Redford, I believe, alongside
Nick Nolte
and Emma Thompson. Yeah. So keep your eye out for that one in the UK. Number 6, I've just touched on it in the US box office, but Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. That one has taken $31 million to date here in the UK after 7 weeks. So not bad at all. I'm sure Tom Cruise will be very pleased with himself.
Yeah.
Number 6 in the US is War Room, which is now into its fourth week. That one is a TriStar film, apparently. A drama starring, directed by Alex Kendrick, who I have no idea who that is, but apparently it's, according to Box Office Mojo, it's ranked number 2 in faith-based successes.
Oh, God.
So, I'm assuming it's kind of a kind of religious dramatic horror or something, I don't know. But it looks crap. In the UK, number 5,
Pixar's still going strong with Inside Out after 8 weeks. That's taken $56 million. Number five in the US, we're about to review it shortly. Everest at number five. It's only been shown in 545 theatres, though, so I'm assuming it's been released on limited release for the first week or so. So I'm sure that will pick up in the US in the next couple of weeks. It does surprise me that it's so low, but as I said, 545 against the number one new release of the week, which has been shown in almost 4,000 theatres across the US. So I'm hoping they've just not decided to not show anybody this film, because it is very good. We'll review it shortly, as I said. And number four in the UK, number one last week, Straight Out of Compton, taken $10 million, or almost 11 in the UK. Does that surprise you at all, that it's taken that much money?
Well, I don't know. It's one of these where it's a biopic of a very popular group.
Mm.
It's got there's a solid fan base of people who were there to see it before it was even going to be made, you know, they existed. And I think it's not a surprise that it's done well. I think what is a surprise is how well it's done and how long it's sticking around for. You can see it's still been in the top 10, you know, come the end of the month, probably even middle of October. But yeah not surprising, really.
Number four in the US is a little known film called The Perfect Guy, which they briefly talked about on last week's show when they were doing the top 10. Because believe it or not, this was number one last week in the US.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
it's kind of straight to DVD type in the UK. Probably,
oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, probably won't get the time of day over here, but $41 million so far in the US, which is just crazy because it's not actually got a particularly recognisable cast, even if I remember from what I was listening to earlier.
Oh, I remember actually seeing the trailer for this. It does. It looks so awful.
Number three, Both Sides of the Pond. We just reviewed it. M. Night Shyamalan's The Visit. It's taken $42 million in the US. It's in its second week there. Here in the UK, it's taken just over $1.5 million, which just shows how small the UK is, isn't it? Actually, it highlights.
Mm-hmm.
How our market is in comparison to our American friends. Number two in the UK is one of the other new releases from last week. It's Maze Runner, The Scorch Trials, or as I also know it as The Hunger Games / Divergent / Harry Potter / every other teen movie that's ever been made that has no real kind of unique quality to it. The guys reviewed it on last week's show. Tony's review for that one is available on the blog. In the US, number two is Johnny Depp's new film, Black Mass, which took $23 million in its first week over in the US. I'm really bored of that one, actually. It's got a really interesting cast. Corey Stoll is among them, but it's quite a
quite a long list of stars. Johnny Depp, as I said, Benedict Cumberbatch, Dakota Johnson, Juno Temple, Joel Edgerton, Kevin Bacon, Sienna Miller, Adam Scott, Corey Stoll, as I already said.
Oh, wow.
So that's really interesting. From director Scott Cooper, who made Out of the Furnace last year.
Oh, yeah, and, that was a good film.
Yeah, and Crazy Heart as well. A few years ago, I think it was about 2009-2010 time, I think. So you got that one, or two in the UK, because number one, no real surprise, is Tom Hardy stars Legend, which took 8 million in the UK and has done very well for itself already, and no doubt will probably hold strong, I would imagine, next week. Probably, even if he doesn't hold on to the top place, we'll certainly still be in the top three. Whereas in the US, just shows what a market these films have. Maze Runner is number one in the US, $31 million in its first week. Quite interesting that that means that we got it first, which is rare. Whoever is watching those films, I do feel for you. And maybe we'll send you a list of films that you should watch instead. Yeah. Which includes our next review. It's Everest.
Those of you who dare face their dreams, Venture Consultants offers something beyond the power of words to describe. And why don't we describe it in the brochure? Because it's mostly just pain.
Yes.
Ain't that the truth?
Hey, put it simply, guys. Human beings simply aren't built to function at the cruising altitude of a 747. Okay, once we get above here, above the South Col, our bodies will be literally dying, and I mean literally dying. It's not called the death zone for nothing, guys. So the game is, can we get you up to the top and down to the bottom before that happens?
On the morning of May 10th, 1996, climbers from two expeditions start their final ascent towards the summit of Mount Everest, the highest point on Earth. With little warning, a violent storm strikes the mountain, engulfing the adventurers in one of the fiercest blizzards ever encountered by man. Challenged by the harshest conditions imaginable, the teams must endure blistering winds and freezing temperatures in an epic battle to survive against nearly impossible odds. Owen, you can go first.
Yes. Okay. The short review, the very short review is... Okay, so the film's 120 minutes. For the first 60 minutes... I thought it was quite dull. I could see what they were trying to do. I could see they were trying to give you an introduction to these characters. You were trying to understand who they were, a little bit about why they were doing this climb to the summit of Everest. Very blatantly, no subtlety at all about it, where you get characters asking, why are you doing this? I thought it was a little bit...
Easy.
But then, so I didn't get attached to any of the characters. I thought, this is going on a bit. I thought, you know... At the 60-minute mark, I thought I must have been going for 2 hours now. How are they going to get back down? Where's the drama? So it was a bit slow. Didn't pull me into it. And then for the last hour, where, as you might expect, almost all of the actual drama occurs, where they're trying to get down the mountain and they're hit by a storm, that's when I suddenly found myself really invested in it. And I'll be honest, it doesn't happen to me very often. It doesn't happen all that often, but... I kind of felt a bit emotional watching it. It really got to me at one point. I thought this is just tragic, especially because it's based on real people. And we have talked about spoilers on this podcast, so I won't repeat what I said earlier. But I just think you know what's going to happen to some of these people.
Yes.
I knew very little about the actual story. There is a documentary about Everest, which was released shortly after this expedition. I think in 1996 the documentary came out. Mm-hmm. But it goes into a little bit about why people on this expedition ended up doing the things that they did at certain points during the trek. But it still really packs a really big emotional punch during this film. And I particularly with Jason Clarke's character, Rob Hall, who leads this expedition, stuff that... The sort of interactions between him and his wife, who's played by Keira Knightley, with a very dodgy accent. I didn't believe her accent for 1 minute. She was, it wasn't great.
But she's never been known for her accent, so...
No. I think she's a little bit of an underrated actress, but her accent there was kind of... It was worse than her posh accent in Imitation Game, and in that she was basically using her own accent. So, yeah. But yeah, so but the interactions between those two characters were really quite touching, and I think you've got to give the director a bit of credit. And how do you pronounce his name, Dan? Would you like to give it a go?
Balthazar Kormakur, I think.
Yes, okay, that'll do. Well, I'll have that. That's fine. Yeah, Balthazar Kormakur. I think he did really, really well in the second half of the film.
Yes. I think they needed to establish something, didn't they? I think they just spent a little bit too long on it. And it's a massive cast as well. You know, you've mentioned obviously Jason Clarke and Keira Knightley, but you've also got Emily Watson. You have Josh Brolin, Jake Gyllenhaal, Robin Wright, who I think got shafted massively because she was barely in it, which, I understand they needed somebody to play that role, but I kind of wanted to put them out because I fucking love Robin Wright. Naoki Mori as well, for any Torchwood fans. It's the first time I've seen her in anything since Torchwood, so it was good to see her again. Sam Worthington, his role, again, didn't really, really kick off until like the last kind of 45 minutes, did it? Again, he was very good. Elizabeth Debicki as well, I'm forgetting someone. Oh, Michael Kelly as well, who's star of House of Cards. But actually quite a lot of nationalities involved in the cast as well. Tom Goodman Hill, who's a British kind of actor. I think he was in The Humans. He was in it for seconds almost, it felt like. The only one of my criticisms is that it wasn't until quite often the costume mask off that I recognised who was actually speaking and who they were concentrating on, with the exception of Jason Clarke, because he was quite obviously wearing that red jacket. Everybody else was like, okay, it's the woman. So it was quite difficult to follow, keeping up with who we were actually, supposed to be concentrating on.
Yes.
And there were certain characters that I didn't like either, and I suppose that's kind of the point, the reflection of real people, but I thought Josh Brolin's character was a bit of an asshole, and I wasn't a particularly big fan of Jake Gyllenhaal's character either, but as I said, they're based on real people, so I suppose that's obviously what those people were like.
Was it? I mean,
yeah,
I read an interview with the director where basically he didn't follow any one person's particular story, because there were lots of accounts of what happened during that trek. You've got the sort of Sherpa's story, you've got what was recorded on the actual radio that they used to communicate. There were actual recordings that they used, which nobody else had really heard. Even the people who've written books about the expedition hadn't heard them. So he got access to this very privileged data. Mm. And I think that He says that they do use a little bit of artistic license, because they've got to, because he's got to tell a story rather than just document what happened. So I think that there is a point where what you're watching is you've just got to stop questioning whether what you're seeing really happened, because in some aspects you just. If you watch it logically, you'll think, well, there's no way anyone would know what happened to this guy.
Yeah,
there's a bit where one of them is gone. I won't say any more, but one of them is gone, and there's no way they would have known the details.
Yes, happened to him.
There would be no one there to tell what had happened and so on. But there is a little bit of artistic license, and they use a bit of evidence that's been collected, and he read all these reports, all these journals, all these people's books, and there were people issuing like counter arguments in books. So one person would publish a book about their side of the story, someone else would read it who was on the expedition and go, well, no, that's not what happened, I better write a book as well. So you get two very conflicting accounts of events. So I think there is a bit of artistic license, but I think at the same time what it does is make it sit into a very cohesive story. So you stop caring about the logics of the logical side of they wouldn't know this happened, they would just have to guess, because they can't do anything else, and it ends up being quite a good solid drama in that sense.
Absolutely. And also, again, suspending belief, none of them looked at all like the characters they were supposed to be playing. Particularly, Jake Gyllenhaal looked nothing like the guy he was supposed to be playing. Like, not even.
Yeah, he had long hair and a beard.
But he was like the real guy. His hair that long, and it was blonde for starters, not dark. And I was like, oh, is that supposed to? That's not who. No, surely they must have got that wrong. So, it was a bit odd that Jake Gyllenhaal in particular looked as far removed from his character as possible. But yeah, no, I admit I had a little bit of a weep towards the end. It was pulling at your heartstrings. And, you know, as you said, the final hour was definitely better than the first. And, you know, as the stakes were being raised, kind of, yeah, it was quite intense. And you know, and as I said, emotional as well. I think Emily Watson was very good, but I don't think she's ever really bad in anything, is she? You mentioned Keira Knightley. She was okay. You know, I'm not the biggest fan of hers. She's a bit winning me round recently, though. She's been in a couple of good roles recently. Yeah. So she's slowly winning me round. But I thought Michael Kelly was really good. As I said, you know, he was probably, other than Jason Clarke's character, the character I was rooting for more than anything. And, you know, obviously there is some really emotions, and it's as you kind of would expect, so it's not really spoiling too much. Not everybody makes it. So, you know, but there are some surprises in there as well, and it's definitely well worth watching. Has that piqued your interest, Chris?
Kind of. I mean, I...
Was that a pun about peaking? Was that
No jokes, gentlemen. I don't know. I mean, to be honest, the fact that you guys have said it's really good kind of sells it, maybe? I mean,
half of it is really good. Half of it is really good.
Yeah.
Just watch the second half. Don't just walk into a cinema an hour later. Love it.
It's not that the first half is bad. I get what they were doing. I just think it could have been tighter. They could have sewn it together a little bit more, because lots of it are just clips of them walking. And it's great. Okay, I know they were actually on location. They were actually filming at Camp One on Everest and all that kind of thing. That's brilliant. And you've got to capture all this natural beauty. And that's part of why people will watch Everest.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it was so slow. It really dragged. And I think you need it. You need it, obviously. You need to be introduced to these guys. You need to have some reason to want them to survive this perilous journey. But it could have just done with maybe, even if it was just 10 or 15 minutes cut out of it.
Yeah.
I think it made it a bit more slick.
Yeah. They had a massive bank of characters to work with. And, you know, so kudos to what they did manage to achieve. And as I said, an hour almost felt a bit too long, but almost in some respects could have been longer, or if it had been done tighter, you know, if they'd have, you know, done a better job at it, maybe we'd be sitting here going, oh no, it was a good 2-hour film rather than it was a good hour.
they could have had sort of three main characters and a lot of peripheral characters, and in the end they just spread it too thinly with all of them. You know, again, as we keep coming back to it, they were real people. They are real people, so it is a little bit sentimental, but not overly so.
Yeah.
In trying to give them each a bit of backstory, a bit of screen time. Well, I know this is slightly off topic, and I know I've listened to a few of the recent Black Hole Cinema podcasts since they've come back, and I don't think this has happened too often. But I'm going to recommend something for people if they liked Everest, because I think it's a film that hasn't been seen enough. Certainly, like, it's not really that popular, but I reckon people would love it if they saw it. And you might not be aware that it even happened, but there's a documentary called The Great White Silence, which is from 1924. Okay, bear with me. It was actually restored quite recently in 2011, and it's all footage taken by Herbert Ponting on the original trek to the South Pole. And it captures that similar kind of feeling of exploring the unknown. And, you know, because of it's all the snowy conditions and the people who are, they get caught. And, you know, if anyone actually knows the real story of the Terra Nova or Captain Scott or anything like that, I think they might enjoy The Great White Silence. Because it's all, like I say, it's about this expedition, it's about this trek. It's just brilliant. It is absolutely brilliant. And I would recommend that above Everest, even though it's a documentary. But it's because it uses all this actual footage of this trek from 1910. And I can't get my head around how they caught a lot of the footage that they do and how well preserved it is. But I just thought I'd throw that out there because I love it. It's one of my favourite documentaries.
No, there we go. That's a Black Hole Cinema first there. A recommendation based on one of the reviews from this week. So you can go find and track it down. If you want to see Everest, however, it'll be in cinemas for the next few weeks. Both sides of the pond in the US, as I said, it's currently at number 5 in the box office. In the UK box office, obviously, it will be appearing in next week's show. So you can find out how well it did here in the UK. Before we wrap up, today's show, though, we'll be revisiting the Hall of Fame. We've done the actors, we've done the actresses, and now we're dealing with directors. We've all chosen two directors who have never won an Academy Award that we wish to induct into our Hall of Fame. Our first choices will be going automatically in. The second nominee we make, we'll have to decide between the three of us which one is the most deserving. So there are four places, as it were, up to grabs. I'll kick us off. My first one is Wes Anderson. I'm putting him straight in to the Hall of Fame. He's been nominated for six Oscars, probably most recently famous for The Grand Budapest Hotel, which, if you've listened to the show previously, you'll have heard Tony gushing over in the past. And I'm sure he'll say how Wes Anderson absolutely should have won an Academy Award for everything that he's been nominated for so far. But he was also nominated for Best Writing back from Moonrise Kingdom. In 2010, he was nominated for Best Animated Feature Film, Fantastic Mr. Fox. And way back in 2002, he was nominated for Best Writing Screenplay Written Directly for the Screen for The Royal Tenenbaums. I've pronounced that incorrectly, haven't I? But never mind. There we go. So that's who I'm inducting straight away. Chris, who are
you? Yes, first choice is going to be Guillermo del Toro, the kind of the Spanish Mexican kind of author of weird, creepy horror fantasy. He has only been nominated for an Academy Award once, and this was for Best Original Screenplay in 2007 for his arguable kind of current masterpiece, which is Pan's Labyrinth. So I think he deserves a lot of Oscars just for being sheer, you know, mental and brilliant. So yeah, that's why I'm putting him in.
The Academy Award for brilliantly mad.
Pretty much, it's like the Academy Award for how the fuck did you think that up?
Yeah.
And I just like to think, just like in a really positive way, it's just like, do you know, that actually really worked and it's nuts.
Maybe there is an Academy Award for the insane. Maybe that's a different award show.
Like there's a special Saturn Award or something. It's just like, yeah. You know. Yeah. Most bonkers sci-fi thing. So Guillermo del Toro.
So that's del Toro and Wes Anderson so far. Owen, who are you putting in first?
Automatically going in is a Korean director called Lee Chang-dong. And I was weighing up who to induct, and I thought I could have put in Stanley Kubrick, I guess. But because I love Stanley Kubrick, he is actually my favourite director. But I thought it would be a bit boring. So I try and sneak some people in who might not make it in automatically. But Lee Chang-dong is one that he's only directed 5 films in total. And the first one of those was in 1997, and the most recent one was in 2010. But every single film of his that he released have just blown me away. All 5 of them have been spectacular. I mean, not just good thrillers or, you know, entertaining horrors or anything like that. He makes these really invested dramas. The most recent one was Poetry, which it comes up on Netflix. If you've got Netflix and you're sort of looking for international films, Poetry is one of those that always just comes up and is recommended. And it's about this old lady who is the guardian of her grandson, and her grandson is accused of committing this horrible crime at school, and at the same time she's losing her memory. She's got the onset of Alzheimer's and dementia, and it's a really touching story. It's just absolutely breathtaking, and all of his films are similar, and they all deal with really heavy themes that other people kind of don't. No, maybe not. Maybe that's incorrect to say other people shy away from them. There are other directors, of course, who tackle these subjects, but he does them in such a really interesting way, and I just cannot recommend him enough. Yeah, it's called Lee Chang-dong, and he's only got 5 films, so if anyone wants to go out there and watch all of his back catalogue, you could do it in a day if you're committed to it. You could do it in a day, but he you will be an emotional wreck by the end of it. So just that warning there, that little caveat.
So that's Wes Anderson, Del Toro, and Chang-dong Lee or Lee Chang-dong?
Lee Chang-dong, because it's a similar sort of thing like in Korea and China and stuff. Their family name comes first. So Lee is his family name, so he's Lee Chang-dong. Bit of trivia for you.
There we go. We put that in the next quiz, shall we? As I said, Lee Chang-dong, Wes Anderson and Del Toro. Up next, we've got three directors that we're nominating and will decide from those three who will be joining those three. My nomination, we've mentioned one of his films already, actually, on the show. It's David Fincher. Most recently, Gone Girl, but also the Social Network back in 2010. Way back in 1999, Fight Club with Brad Pitt, and also when Brad Pitt joined Morgan Freeman for Seven back in 1995. So he's made many a brilliant film. Some of them have won Oscars, either in acting categories or been best film category. Did Social Network win back in 2010? I can't remember. I think it definitely won something.
I think it did, yeah.
Yeah, won three Oscars. Yeah, Best Writing, Aaron Sorkin. Best Achievement in Film Editing. Best Achievement in Music Written for Motion Pictures. And Best Motion Picture of the Year. And Best Performance by a Leading Role. Did he win them all? No. The three that won was Best Writing, Best Achievement in Film Editing, and Best Achievement in Music Written for Motion Pictures. So it won three Oscars back in 2011. So, yeah, that's my nomination. Owen. Who are you nominating?
I will be very surprised if you guys pick this.
Fair enough.
Albert Pyun is who I'm nominating. And you probably don't recognise the name because he makes a lot of B-movies. And if you have heard of his name, it's going to be for one of two reasons. Either you've seen Cyborg, starring Jean-Claude Van Damme, a sci-fi movie from the 80s. Have you? Probably not. Anyway, the other reason you may have heard his name is because he was the director of the failed Captain America film in the 90s. The early 90s, yeah. That's him. That's who I am nominating for this. But I'll give you a reason why. I basically spent far too much time this year watching his films because I get intrigued. I get hooked by the synopsis of them. You read the premise of his films online and it just sounds like spectacular and you've got to watch it. Like, I'll give you this one. This one's called, this is the actual title of the film, Brain Smasher, A Love Story. Okay, that's the title. The description is, Sam, a professional model, discovers her sister is battling Chinese Shaolin monks and unwittingly enlists a goofy nightclub bouncer for help. That is the description. Does that not make you want to watch that film?
That does sound kind of amazing, actually.
It kind of does.
It kind of does. Heatseeker. In this futuristic thriller, a human kickboxing champion refuses to join a tournament fighting cyborg fighters until the event sponsor kidnaps his fiance. Come on. Does that not just intrigue you just a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, the interrogation of Cheryl Cooper. A young woman waits in a room. She assumes it's a police interrogation room. The detective tells her she's the only survivor of a mass killing that evening.
Exactly.
I can see where that's going.
But I mean, there's a few films of his that I haven't seen yet that I really want to see. So Doll Man is one I want to see, and it says, as the title probably gives away, a hard-boiled intergalactic policeman lands on Earth where he is only 12 inches tall. I mean, these films get made. These are real films. He's made them.
Wow.
I just think he's just fantastic at what he does. So he takes all these incredible, like, ridiculous, completely over-the-top ideas, these concepts, works with a very limited budget, and in most cases makes a watchable film, which is an achievement in itself for some of them.
This is quite funny. Like, on his IMDb biography, for some reason it says... Unintentionally born in San Diego. Like, how is someone unintentionally born somewhere?
Oh, they were just driving through and they're like, oh god, we've got to get to Texas. We've just got to, oh, we've got to get to California. Yeah. Ah, sorry, the kid's out. Ah, shit. Where are we? Yeah. San Diego. Ah, shit. Fuck.
But I've got, like, I genuinely have this admiration for him because I think what he does is brilliant. I think the fact that he can make films and use these incredible stories. I read an interview with him before. I watched an interview, I think. I might have watched it. And someone asked him what his obsession with cyborgs and kickboxing is. And he just says, I don't really care for cyborgs or kickboxing. They just happen to be in my films a lot. And it's just like, yeah.
Brilliant.
He just makes ton of cyborg kickboxers because he can. I think that's brilliant.
Apparently there have been four kickboxers.
Yes. He didn't direct the first one either.
Kickboxer 4, The Aggressor. And that's that. There probably might even be more. He made quite a lot of actually sequels. Like he's done apparently Nemesis 4, Death Angel.
Yeah.
Nemesis 3, Time Lapse.
But Nemesis 2 is nothing like Nemesis. The Nemesis is about with Oliver Grenier in it as a sort of really just constantly topless, heavily muscled cyborg guy. And in the second one, it's about a time-traveling woman who... It's just confusing. It doesn't make a lick of sense. But at the same time, like I keep coming back to it, I just love the fact he makes these films. Yeah. I love it. And it does, I kind of love him for it.
Yeah, it does seem like you're kind of straight to DVD, might buy them at like a petrol station for 99p type films.
if any of his films other than Cyborg have been released theatrically, I will fall off my chair. I don't think they have. But yeah, there are a few people better at what they do, particularly in that B-movie genre. It's kind of like a modern Roger Corman, before Roger Corman would turn to being just a producer, if that sort of gives anyone a sort of frame of reference. He's the kind of godfather of B-movies. And Albert Pyon's sort of like a modern version of Roger Corman.
I almost don't want to hear Chris's. I almost want to just put him straight in. Okay, Chris, what's your nomination?
I don't know if mine can compete, but mine's the kind of very traditional. I would really like to see Alfred Hitchcock in this because he is kind of one of the most influential filmmakers there's ever been, particularly in terms of how directors actually use the camera to build up tension and fear and suspense. And he really is kind of the best at doing that. So if you look at his back catalogue, there are films like Shadow of a Doubt or Psycho or Vertigo or Rear Window or The Lady Vanishes on the 39 Steps. Or there are hundreds and hundreds, well, hundreds, that's a bit of an exaggeration. There are I was really thinking, he's prolific, he's not that prolific. There are dozens and dozens of films that he's managed to do, and they're all distinctly kind of Hitchcockian in that there's this psychosexual vibe to a lot of them. A lot of them are very dark, a lot of them have a very twisted sense of humour. And it's really impressive to the man's kind of calibre and his history as a filmmaker that he has, completely changed how we view horror and how we view the thriller or the action movie. And yet, weirdly, he has never won an Oscar. He did receive the Irving G. Thalberg Memorial Award, which I don't think counts as a real Oscar because it's not even shaped like an Oscar. So generally
that's
it's
the defining category, yeah.
Yeah, it's got to be shaped like an Oscar.
Well, it's given out at the award, but you don't get, it's not a competitive nomination. So they just decide, each year, oh, okay, we'll give it to so-and-so this year. Yeah, great, whatever. And I think, the thing, it's not shaped like an Oscar, it's just shaped like the guy who it's named after. So I've never seen one, so I don't know if it's just like his face or if it's like an actual kind of weird gold thing of the,
a gold man. Yeah.
A gold man. So yeah, it's kind of surprising to me that he never actually received any kind of awards himself. He films did. Several of his, leading ladies and actresses did receive awards. So I believe John Fontaine received one for Suspicion in 1941, I think. I've probably got that completely wrong. I apologise. I believe that the writer of Rear Window received an Academy Award for adapting the screenplay from the original short story. But no, it's really surprising to me, given that Hitchcock is a massive, massive influence on cinema as a whole, and yet there's no actual recognition for him. There's no, there is no Academy Award, which is the pinnacle. Whether or not we like it or not, whether or not we actually buy into the idea that, awards are, they're meaningless or whatever, it's still surprising.
He's kind of the grandfather of horror, wasn't he, really?
He really is.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he is like the king of suspense. So if you've never seen a Hitchcock film, then, there are plenty of websites there that kind of advertise the best ones.
So nominations is David Fincher, Albert Pyun, is that Pyun?
Pyun, I think it is, yeah.
Pyun, yeah. Albert Pyun, and obviously Alfred Hitchcock. I'll kick off the voting. My vote will go to the granddaddy of horror himself, Alfred Hitchcock. Chris, you can't nominate your own. So.
I know. It's fine, to be honest. I listen to the other nominations as much as I would like to give my vote to a guy who created a film called Doll Man. and it's going to be David Fincher. I love so much of David Fincher's films. Like, Seven is one of my favourite all-time favourite films, and I love the recent stuff like Gone Girl and Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. So, it has to go here. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry, Owen.
That's okay. I expected it. I thought it was fine.
The swing vote, Owen.
Yeah.
I am going to massively swing in favour towards Alfred Hitchcock. There are Fincher films that I like, but Hitchcock's body of work is just phenomenal. I mean, it's incredible that one man made the quality of film that he did so often. And like we've talked about, the impact, the influence that he's had on other filmmakers. Yes, it's got to be Hitchcock, I'm afraid. Sorry, Dan.
It's all right. I think it would have been wrong to have not had Alfred Hitchcock amongst our Hall of Fame, particularly because, as we've already mentioned, he didn't actually win a proper, I'm calling it in inverted commas, a proper Oscar. So hopefully he'll be up there thinking, well, at least I've been voted into Black Hole Cinema's Hall of Fame. That makes it all worthwhile.
I'm not sure Albert Pyun will be contented with just being mentioned.
In fact, he probably is. He's probably, you know, beside himself with joy.
Of course, yeah.
So that means our four going into the Hall of Fame, Wes Anderson, Del Toro, and Lee Chang-dong, and obviously Alfred Hitchcock. So those are the four joining our actors and actresses. Find the full list of those on the website, blackholeonline.wordpress.com. At the moment, have got a domain name coming, as well as we'll be launching very shortly on Acast. So we're joining you, Owen, on Acast. How's that going for you on Acast? Are you liking it?
I do like it, yeah. I'm not sure how many people listen to our podcast directly in Acast, but it's brilliant that it gives you the option to be a bit more interactive with it. So if people listen to Black Hole Cinema on Acast, what Tony could do, what we do with Fail Critics, is you can bookmark specific sections. So people don't have to listen to it in the order that you record it. If someone thinks, well, what I want to do first is go to the main reviews and then go back and listen to the box office news and then I'll have a look at recommendations, they could do that if they want. You know, depending what Tony does. You can also link directly to articles. So I use it a lot for if people are listening to Fail Critics and we talk about, say, The Visit. I could link to Andrew Brooker's review of The Visit on our website and people can just click on the link straight from the podcast, straight in from Twitter even. It's just a fantastic tool, I think. And it's been great for us. Our listeners' numbers have increased and I don't know why. I can only assume it's the fact that we're on Acast now, not that we've suddenly become better in the last few months. But yeah, it's a great little platform for podcast hosting and for people listening to podcasts as well.
That's great. So that is all coming soon. Hopefully, as I said, the domain name and as well launching on Acast. When that does happen, the link will be available from the blog. You can find us all on Twitter, Black Hole Cinema, obviously at Black Hole Cinema. I am at Dan Thomas Taylor. Owen, you're at OHughes86.
I am, yeah.
Yeah, and Chris, you're at Hire_boy. So that's where you can find us. Thanks for joining me, gents. It was a good show. Hopefully the listeners will agree.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Not a problem. I'm sure you'll both be back on soon. You can find the guys, as I said, Chris. You can listen to Fan Friction, which will be coming back shortly. And you can listen to Owen over at failcritics.com. As I said, thanks for joining me, guys.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.